Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date is October 9th, 2021, and I'm your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's talk is From EBM to FBM, Gender Equity in the House of Medicine. This is an SGEM Extra episode. I had the honor of co-presenting at the Renaissance School of Medicine, Stony Brook University, Department of Emergency Medicine, Grand Rounds this week. Now, you may be wondering, why is a middle-aged, white, heterosexual, cisgender, male atheist nerd co-presenting on gender equity in the House of Medicine?
And isn't it ironic, don't you think? A little too ironic. And yeah, I really do think.
I can. Well, I guess I can see why you would think that it's ironic that you're giving this talk, but let me share my take on it with you. So the first time that I heard you give this talk was at a FemmeNEM conference a couple of years ago. And we all know that FemmeNEM is a conference, it's an organization for females in emergency medicine. So it kind of made sense that you were one of the only three male speakers there. But, you know, when you went up there and you were talking about all this, I didn't think that, why is this white male physician giving a talk on gender equity? Instead, I was like, wow, look at this guy using really high quality evidence to bring down the patriarchy. And I was blown away. I was absolutely blown away. And it made me think, you know, about Peter Parker's uncle, Uncle Ben, who said, with great power comes great responsibility, and I'm just so thankful that you use your power and privilege to be such a strong ally and advocate for this cause.
Well, for those who are not nearly as nerdy as us, Peter Parker and Uncle Ben are from Spider-Man. But you know what? I really like Star Trek. So according to Sir Patrick Stewart, he played Captain Jean-Luc Picard, quote, people won't listen to you or take you seriously unless you're an old white man. So I guess that makes me an old white man now, Suchi. So I'm going to use that to help people who need it. But I haven't formally introduced you yet. So let me formally introduce you to the SGEM listeners. This is my talented co-presenter, Dr. Suchi Data. She is an assistant professor in the Department of Emergency Medicine and GME Diversity Leader for the NYU Long Island School of Medicine. Welcome to the SGEM, Suchi.
Thank you so much for having me, Ken. It's just absolutely wonderful to be here.
Yeah, so what are we going to be talking about today?
Right, so today we're going to be giving an evidence-based talk on scientific misogyny and other gender equity issues in academic emergency medicine.
And since this was a CME event set up for Grand Rounds, they asked us to give three objectives for the presentation. So let's do that. What are the three objectives for this presentation?
So our first objective for the Grand Rounds that we gave was to recognize gender inequity in the House of Medicine.
Yeah, and the second one was to identify the gender inequities in each of the three pillars of evidence-based medicine, and then show a progression from evidence-based medicine to humanist-based medicine.
Right, and kind of as our last objective, took all of that and really brought it home to the bedside and talked about how these gender inequities can impact the cardiovascular care of women.
So let's start the presentation on this gender inequity issue with an anecdote, one of the lowest forms of evidence. So Suchi, can you share your story of your journey from medical school through residency, and then finally as an attending woman practicing emergency medicine?
Thanks for asking, Ken. I would actually love to share my story with you. So my journey started at none other than the Renaissance School of Medicine, which back in my day was known as Stony Brook School of Medicine. And it's actually here that I met my now husband, Neil, and you've met him.
Were you treated the same through your medical training while in undergrad, or were there differences that you noticed how, you know, you interacted as the two of you went through medical school? Because you weren't a couple at that time.
No, we weren't. So, yeah. So, you know, I think we were treated pretty equally. I don't really remember being at any different. But I do remember that both of us were just constantly working really hard, and we were both just relieved and really happy when it was over. And actually, we stood next to each other at our medical school graduation and ended up reading the Hippocratic Oath from the same piece of paper. He'd, of course, forgotten his copy, and mine was the only one that was available to both of us.
And then your journey continued to travel together when you both matched to the same EM residency program. Now, was that planned by the end of medical school? Were you like looking at each other going, hey, let's match together and keep this going?
Yeah. So, you know, I don't know if you're going to believe me, and I don't know if our friends believe us, but it actually was completely unplanned and totally unintentional. Neil was still mostly in the friend zone until about halfway through our emergency medicine training. So we ended up getting married the last year of residency, and shortly after we signed our first contract as attending physicians at a community site in Maryland.
So after residency, you left the big smoke and went rural. Oh, you know that I've been practicing rurally for my whole career, 26 years in a rural community. So you went to a critical access hospital in the community.
Yeah, after residency, Neil and I left New York and we went to work at an emergency room that was associated with a critical access hospital out in the community. It was an emergency room that took care of patients who had low healthcare literacy and poor access to primary care. So as a result, we just saw an incredible amount of pathology, and it was overall just a tough place to work. Very resource deprived and often frustrating and exhausting. But Neil and I learned a lot, and we really got to develop ourselves as EM physicians while we were working there.
Well, I'd like to get back to the issue of gender inequity. You didn't notice much in the medical school years. You didn't mention anything about residency. But how about once you started practice? Was there a difference that you noticed once you started practicing as an attending physician at this high volume, high acuity critical access hospital?
Right. So this is where my story starts to get juicy and interesting. In terms of compensation and promotion, initially, Neil and I both seemed to be progressing pretty nicely at our new job. But everything changed about a year into it, right when I got pregnant.
So what impact did pregnancy have on being an EM attending working at a critical care access hospital?
So about 8 months into my pregnancy, you know, when I'm like waddling around the ER, intubating patients, putting in central lines, I started noticing that I was making significantly less money than my husband. And you're probably wondering why, right? Well, a significant part of our compensation at that time was based on our productivity. In the US, we call this RVU-based compensation. And I was expected to see just as many patients an hour as my non-pregnant counterparts. And, you know, I couldn't do it. Not without causing a significant amount of physical stress, especially towards the end of my third trimester. So I decided that I would just make less money instead of potentially harming my pregnancy.
Well, that must have been really difficult, you know, near the end of your pregnancy for sure. One of the questions, though, that I have is about night shifts, because I know at critical care access hospitals, you go down to single coverage. And I've got a hard enough time being a middle-aged person doing night shifts, bouncing back from night shifts, being able to function, you know, on an overnight shift. It must have been incredibly difficult being 8 or 9 months pregnant doing solo coverage night shift work.
Yeah, I'll be honest with you, Ken. It really wasn't that much fun. For starters, our commute to work was about an hour each way, so that sort of came with its own set of difficulties and discomforts, right? But getting back to what you were saying about night shift, my scheduler at that time, who was an older female in her mid-60s, who herself didn't work any overnights because, you know, she was in her mid-60s, she decided that I needed to work my, quote, fair share of every shift, including evenings and overnights, throughout the entirety of my pregnancy. But, you know, I was lucky in that my husband was there, so he was able to swap into a lot of these shifts, as many as he could, but there were still a few that I had to go in for. And I remember being 9 months pregnant, going into an overnight, which was a time when our department went down to single coverage, which means that I was the only attending there. And I remember thinking to myself, what was going to happen if I went into labor? Who was going to code that cardiac arrest if I was busy delivering my baby? But somehow this thought didn't occur to my scheduler.
Well, night shifts are tough, and I just can't imagine doing them while pregnant. But you did mention this commute for over an hour both ways. I live in Canada, so I'm pretty familiar with commuting through snowy weather. That must have been pretty tough for you guys, though, in the middle of the winter, going back and forth more than an hour each way to a rural hospital.
Oh my God, do I have a story for you. But before I get started, I just want you to know that everyone's okay at the end of the story, so, you know, you can relax. So remember how I told you about those really not so nice, crummy night shifts that my husband would swap into for me? Well, it was during one of these traded shifts, the dead of winter, that my husband got into a bad car accident coming home from work. His car was totaled and completely non-functional, and he ended up being stranded on the side of the road in the middle of nowhere without heat. And the roads were so icy that it was hours before a tow truck could get to him and bring him home. If I didn't have my husband to swap that shift with me, that would have been me in that car accident. And, you know, I don't know if I would have had the same ending to share with you.
Well, I'm glad that Neil was not hurt in the car accident. You know, cars can be replaced, but your BFFs are really hard to replace. I hope the delivery went well, though, after that exciting story, and you enjoyed some nice paid maternity leave.
Ken, your Canadian naivety is absolutely hilarious. Paid maternity leave? Not quite. Not at all, actually. My maternity leave was 100% unpaid. I had to fight just to keep my benefits, which were $250 a month. And beyond this, my maternity benefit was basically the ability to take 12 weeks of unpaid leave through the Family and Medical Leave Act, or what we call FMLA. And, you know, I found myself not really being ready to come back after 12 weeks of maternity leave. But my scheduler wouldn't have it. Remember her? My scheduler, the female in her mid-60s? She reminded me that back in her day, she got 2 weeks off after delivering her baby, and then it was straight back to work. So tough luck, Buttercup. Time to get back to the grind so that your colleagues can take Memorial Day weekend off.
Wait a minute. So you had to take unpaid maternity leave and then jump right back into it. And when you jump right back into it, they schedule you for a Memorial Day weekend. Well, tell me, come on, please, Suchi, tell me at least they accommodated you and found you a place so that you could pump while on shift.
You would think so, right? But it was actually quite the opposite. I went back to work pretty reluctantly because I was very worried that I wouldn't be able to produce enough breast milk to feed my daughter. And my fears seemed to materialize when my milk supply took a huge hit from the stress of the ER and the complete lack of a supportive environment. There was a single lactation room for the whole hospital, and it was located an entire floor away from the ED. My boss was pretty supportive, and he let me use his office to pump, but otherwise, the general feeling was that breastfeeding was a luxurious choice that I was making. Which is so ridiculous, right? Because how is feeding my child an option? There were just so many sighs and eye rolls that followed, "Hey guys, I'll be right back, I have to pump," every time I said it.
Well, how did the need to go and pump and, you know, you said you had to go to another floor or use your boss's office. I mean, if you're doing that, if you're pumping, you're not seeing patients and you're working on an RVU standard. So it must have affected your income in some way.
Right. You called it, Ken. I started seeing that a huge chunk of money was disappearing from every one of my paychecks. It turns out that the company was charging me for taking the time to pump instead of seeing patients. And again, I was being held to the same productivity standards as my non-lactating counterparts.
Wow, you must have gotten really tired and frustrated, you know, going to work so you could pay someone else, like a nanny or something, to raise your child or take care of your child while your employer was docking you pay while you were going to, you know, produce breast milk to feed your daughter.
I was frustrated. I was very frustrated. Here I was working harder, seeing patients and pumping, only to make less money than my husband and other non-lactating colleagues. And this was all because I have the biologic ability to bear children and generate nourishment for them, whereas my male colleagues don't.
Yeah, but, it, you know, like, this is not a new thing, right? Like, people know where babies come from, right? And didn't your employer not anticipate the decrease in productivity because of your pregnancy and breastfeeding?
I guess not. And what I find ironic is that we'd been spared these productivity measures during the first 6 months of our jobs because it was expected that we would struggle as new graduates and employees, right? But the same consideration wasn't made for me when I was pregnant or lactating.
Well, I do know that you left the critical care access hospital and moved back to the big smoke. Was there a straw that broke the proverbial camel's back that gave you that final nudge to head back to the city?
Yeah, so there was, and it came at the end of our third year. My husband got offered partnership status with the company, but then when I met with leadership, I was told that I needed another year to prove myself before they would consider me for partnership. And my husband and I were both livid about this. It made no sense at all. I guess working 9 months pregnant and then coming back 3 months postpartum while pumping wasn't enough proof for them.
Well, you came back to the city, the three of you, so now it's your BFF Neil and your beautiful new daughter. So tell us about your experience moving back to the city.
Right, so by the end of the 3 years, Neil and I kind of decided that we wanted more from our jobs, and we found ourselves on a journey back to academic medicine and also back home to New York.
Well, were things different when you got back to the city? And indifferent, I'm hoping better?
Yeah, they've been a lot better. Since our move back, our careers have been taking off and we're both doing well and slowly climbing the ranks at our jobs. And we both feel like we're well appreciated and supported at work. But there's always that but, right? I still find that often I'm worried that my commitment to work may not be taken seriously because of my commitment to my children. And I don't think Neil's had the same insecurities.
So I'm curious, do you think that having children has been a strength? Has it, you know, made you stronger, or is it a weakness as you travel through your career?
You know, I think that my kids can be perceived as a weakness, but they're definitely my biggest strengths. They've taught me to be very efficient and multitask, and I'm sure you can relate to this, Ken. As a father yourself, they've also given me a lot of experience with being very functional with very little sleep.
Well, I don't know if people noticed, but you said kids, children, plural. So you went through a second pregnancy. Well, how did that compare to the first pregnancy experience?
Yes, Ken, I did. I went through a second pregnancy and I actually had my second child during the pandemic. I was about 26 weeks pregnant in March of 2020, right when COVID was really kind of starting to take off in New York. And it was scary. It was really scary being pregnant and having a child during the pandemic. But I was fortunate because my institution was supportive and my boss took me out of the department and put me on the virtual front lines instead. So I was able to work for the virtual urgent care through our institution up until I delivered in July 2020. But I know that not all my pregnant colleagues were quite as lucky as me, and you know, that makes me sad. I really wish everyone had that option.
Yeah, there was a lot of anxiety back in March 2020, and totally understandable. Being a frontline healthcare clinician, you know, the anxiety that you're putting yourself in front of this new infectious disease that we don't know much about. But to add to that, that you've got another individual to worry about, a pregnancy, that must have been pretty difficult.
It was.
So you had your second child. How was that maternity leave compared to that first unpaid experience?
It was so much better at my current institution. For starters, I was able to take paid maternity leave. Isn't that insane? Absolutely revolutionary, right? And what's even crazier than that is that my institution is still standing. No riots, no protests. Instead, what they have is a super grateful and happy employee.
Yeah, maybe you should have given a trigger warning for that one, too, for people to pull over to the side of the road if they were listening to this. You know, or please sit down before you listen to this next section.
I know, paid maternity leave. What a shocker.
What were your colleagues like when you returned, though? Did you have a place to pump this time, and were they able to control their eye rolls?
Yes, my colleagues were very supportive when I came back at my new job. They helped me find this time and the space to pump, and definitely no eye rolls or sighs. Just the culture was very different.
So that sounds good, but let's get down to the, you know, nitty gritty. What about the pay? Was there still a pay gap at your new job because of your being pregnant and then having to pump breast milk?
Absolutely. And, you know, even though it wasn't quite as obvious, it's still there. Just like the rest of the House of Medicine, the pay gap still exists for women in more subtle and pervasive ways, like constantly being mistaken for the nurse or other support staff and being asked to get a warm blanket or urinal or a glass of water. Complaints from the patients that they never saw a doctor, which can really affect your patient satisfaction scores, or the fact that female physicians often need to spend more time with patients than men do to convince them of the same thing.
Yeah, all of these things must slow you down compared to your male partners.
Yeah, they do, and it can really affect your productivity.
So your story's not unique. I mean, I've heard many times from my female colleagues, they tell me they're regularly mistaken for a nurse. Now, what I mean by regularly is multiple times during the same shift. And yet that's despite them wearing a badge that says doctor, wearing a lab coat that's embroidered that says physicians that have multiple letters after the end of their name, and then introducing themselves as a doctor. Do you know how many times I've been mistaken for a nurse, Suchi?
I'm going to say zero times.
Yeah, it's actually not a nice round number. One time.
Wow.
One time I was mistaken for a nurse, and it's when I was asked to get a warm blanket, and I went and got in a warm blanket. Oh, what a nice nurse, right? And I'm not disparaging nurses in any way. They're care at the bedside. Hospitals don't function without nurses. But as a male physician, I've only been interrupted for that purpose, being mistaken for a nurse one time in over 26 years.
Right, and I'm lucky if I'm mistaken for a nurse only once a shift. And it used to be easy, right? The doctor was a white man and everyone else was not. But now, physicians come in all sizes, shapes, genders, and colors. It just makes things a lot more complicated.
But I also think it makes things a lot better. And thank you, Suchi, for sharing your personal experience of gender inequity in the House of Medicine. Is there anything else you want to say before we move on to the evidence-based medicine section?
You know, Neil and I took our first step as physicians together, side by side on that graduation stage that I told you about. We're both capable and compassionate physicians, good friends, amazing parents, and supportive partners. And yet, at one point during our journey through medicine together, I've had to work harder than him to make less money. And whereas he can stroll into a room and just be recognized and accepted as the doctor, I have to do a lot more work to prove my qualifications to my patient.
Yeah, that must be a constant frustration experienced by many women and probably not experienced by that many men.
It is frustrating, but I have to be careful and modulate my emotions more than my husband, because it's a lot more likely that I'm going to be perceived as emotional, weak, or threatening, and sometimes all three.
Well, I appreciate you sharing your experience. However, it is an anecdote, and that doesn't make it wrong.
Absolutely. I think it's only fair that the audience would want more evidence that there is gender inequity in the House of Medicine. Even if a bunch of other women came forward and shared a story that was similar to mine, the plural of anecdote is not data, right?
Exactly. So let's give the listeners some data, Dr. Data. We will frame this part of the presentation using the evidence-based medicine model. And just to remind everyone, the definition that I use is the one put forth by Dr. Sackett. EBM is the conscientious, explicit, and judicious use of the current best evidence in making decisions about the care of individual patients.
I think it's a great idea to start with a definition, because people often think of EBM as just being about the literature, whereas in actuality, the literature is just one of the three pillars of EBM.
Exactly. There are three pillars to evidence-based medicine, and this can be represented in a Venn diagram with three circles. So you can have a blue circle, which is used to represent the literature. It should inform our care. The literature should guide our care, but the literature should not dictate our care.
Right. And then there's the green circle, which represents the clinician, or us. That's the part of EBM where, as physicians, we still need to use our good clinical judgment in applying the literature.
And of course, the patient's values and preferences. And this is represented in the Venn diagram in a red circle. We need to ask our patients what they value, what they would prefer. And it's easy. All you have to do is ask them. Don't assume. Okay, Suchi, it's time to push some of the audience out of their comfort zone. So let's give them some evidence demonstrating the gender inequity in medicine.
Let's do it. Let's use the three pillars of EBM, the literature, the clinicians, and patients, and point out some serious issues with gender inequity within the EBM model.
Yeah, now we're going to be making a number of claims, and we have references to support each of these positions that we're going to put forward. And also remember that you can get copies of these slides, and the references will be available on the SGEM blog. Okay, so that first circle of the Venn diagram, that is the blue circle, the medical literature. And there are many examples of gender inequity in the medical literature. For starters, females are less likely to get grants to fund their research compared to men. Women are less likely to rise to the top academic positions within a university in general compared to men. And then men are more likely to rise to the top academic positions within medicine itself.
Right, and following that trend within medicine in general, the same holds true for emergency medicine, where men are more likely to rise to the top academic positions than women. If you look at medical publications in general, and also for emergency medicine and pediatric emergency medicine, or PEM, men are more likely to be the first author. Our PEM colleagues are almost two-thirds, about 62% female, but only 42% of the lead authors on PEM papers are women.
Yeah, and so PEM is pediatric emergency medicine, and so while they make up the majority of those practicing pediatric emergency medicine, they make up the minority of the lead authors on papers about pediatric emergency medicine. Women are also excluded from being the participants in the medical research, though. And there's a book by the Institute of Medicine, which is a good resource discussing the ethical and legal issues of including or excluding women in clinical trials.
Right. And perhaps the most egregious example that we found where studies have excluded women from research was the study that looked at the association between various factors and uterine cancer. Guess who they excluded?
I'm going to say men, because it was about, you know, uterine cancer.
Well, close, but not quite. It was actually women.
Yeah, and we need to ensure that women are getting equal access to that grant money so they can ask questions that are important to women and create the medical literature that informs the care of women.
Right. And this will lead to more women being the first author in medical publications. We need to include women as participants in medical research instead of excluding them and just extrapolating from male subjects. That's just bad science.
Well, the second pillar of evidence-based medicine is the clinician, represented by the green circle in the Venn diagram. And there are many examples of gender inequity in this second pillar. Men have historically been the physician in the room, while women have historically been the nurse, or mistaken for the nurse.
And given this historical perception and bias, it's not totally unsurprising that men are more likely to rise to the top leadership positions within the hospital. Women make up 50% of medical students and often more, and 80% of the healthcare workforce. And yet, when you look at leadership, women make up only 3% of healthcare CEOs, 3% of CMOs, 6% of department chairs, and 9% of division chiefs. That's just depressing.
Yeah, the majority of the healthcare workforce is women. I think it's the majority now of medical students, but at least it's 50% are women, and yet they're in the single digits of those lead positions like CEO, Chief Executive Officer, CMO, Chief Medical Officer, department chairs, those types of things.
Right. And so I guess I want to ask you, Ken, why do men make more money in general?
Well, that's pretty easy to answer, actually. Men tend to choose these higher paying careers like being a doctor, being an engineer, a lawyer, or a CEO.
Right. And of course, women are more likely to choose lower paying jobs like female doctor, female engineer, female lawyer, or female CEO.
Sarcasm alarm. All right, well, let's dig in to that pay difference, Suchi, between genders in the House of Medicine. What is the evidence, and can you give us a dollar amount to support the claim that male physicians get paid more than female physicians?
I know you're the EBM guy, Ken, so I came prepared with my numbers today. So if you look at the U.S., in terms of U.S. dollars, male physicians get paid $20,000 more a year than female physicians in medicine in general. They get paid $17,000 more a year in academic medicine and get paid $12,000 more than female physicians in academic emergency medicine. I keep thinking of what I would do with all that extra cash.
Yeah, and I don't want to have this be a let's bash on U.S. healthcare, because it's not a unique problem reported only in the U.S. There was actually a study just published last month in JAMA quantifying the differences in Canadian physicians' pay. Now, this was a cross-sectional study including over 31,000 physicians, so almost all the physicians that work in my home province of Ontario. Now, they quantified the dollars, of course, not in U.S. dollars. They had to be in Canadian money, which is loonies and toonies. I don't want to have to, you know, quantify the exchange rate, so why don't we just look at percentages? In Canada, specifically in Ontario, what was the comparison between men and women physicians?
Right, so they found that women earned 33% less annually and 23% less daily than their male counterparts. After they adjusted for various factors like specialty, practice characteristics, and rural versus urban setting, the study found that female physicians earned 14% less than male physicians.
Yeah, and we really need to point that out, because one of the comments people often make is, well, women don't work as much, as long hours, they don't see as many people, they're less productive, all these types of things. And so they actually adjusted for as many things as they could and still found a double-digit percentage difference when controlling for these factors. And again, this is not unique to Canada, it's not unique to the U.S. This gender pay gap is similar to what's reported in the U.K., where they have a study showing a 17% gender pay gap for their hospital doctors. Well, you know, you might be asking yourself, hey, Ken, what can be done about this gender pay gap? Well, Dr. Michelle Cohen and Dr. Tara Kieran wrote a great article called Closing the Gender Pay Gap in Canadian Medicine. And I would encourage people to read this article, and I'll put a link in the show notes. It defines the problem and dispels some of the myths around this topic.
So, real quick, let's go through and answer 5 questions about this issue.
Oh, you must know that 5 is my favorite number.
And that's because...
I can count to it on one hand.
First of all, is the gender pay gap real?
Yes.
So do women make less because they just work less or less efficiently than men do?
No.
So if that's not the case, what are the root causes of this pay gap?
Well, like a lot of things, it's complicated.
What about other jurisdictions?
Well, for some spaced repetition, it's similar. Like, we presented some evidence that it is evident in the US, in Canada, and in the UK. Some jurisdictions are farther ahead in dealing with this issue, and some are lagging farther behind.
And I guess that brings us to the final and most important question. What can we do about this gender pay gap?
Well, what I would suggest you do is listen to the SGEM Extra podcast episode on this, and then you can hear an actual expert, Dr. Michelle Cohen, and her suggestions and some of the solutions. But we've got to get back to that third circle of the Venn diagram, and that's the patients, the red circle. This is the third pillar of evidence-based medicine, and it too shows evidence of gender inequity.
If you look at our patient pool, statistics will suggest that women are more likely to access and utilize healthcare when compared to men. And also, as mothers, women make approximately 80% of healthcare decisions for their children. And despite the greater utilization and decision-making, research shows that women are systematically undertreated.
Yeah, for example, if you look at painful conditions and look at oligoanalgesia, not appropriately addressing pain, women are 7% less likely to get any analgesia and 10% less likely to get an opioid compared to men for the same painful condition.
Right, and you can argue that pain is a subjective experience, right? But gender discrepancies can be quantified for more objective conditions like, well, ACS and associated mortality. Women are less likely to be diagnosed and treated for ACS, which is associated with double the odds of dying. Compared to pain, mortality is a very objective, patient-oriented outcome.
Yeah, you can't be mostly dead, unless, of course, you're a huge Princess Bride fan, which I am. But, you know, don't spill the beans here. We're going to talk more about ACS, or acute coronary syndrome, at the end of this presentation. Now, I took that Venn diagram, which is three colors, and I've modified it, and I'll put a copy in the show notes that we showed earlier to summarize this section of gender inequity in the House of Medicine based on the EBM model.
Now, remember, EBM is more than just a relevant scientific literature, right?
Yeah, I keep having to banging that drum. It's not just about the literature. That's just one of the three pillars. Clinical judgment. I mean, we need to use our clinical judgment. Otherwise they could just replace us with some algorithm and put that in place. We need to use our clinical judgment. There's clinical gestalt. There's subtle things that we can pick up. Sometimes we'll have lots of experience in an area. Other times we won't, and we'll have to lean more towards the literature.
Right. And in addition to all this, we have to remember to respect patient autonomy and agency as well. We may be the one who read all the books and papers and are the expert on medicine, but ultimately, they're the expert on their own experience and story.
Yeah, we need to ensure that everyone gets the emergency care they need, regardless of whether they identify as a male or as a female. Patients deserve the best care based on the best evidence.
Right, and especially in the emergency department. Because the emergency department is like a lighthouse, right? It's a beacon. It's the one place in the House of Medicine where the light is always on and will treat anyone for anything at any time. And hopefully it'll do so without any judgment or bias.
Yeah, and actually we purposely dichotomized this discussion so far into male and female. This is a false dichotomy. Gender is complex, and people do not necessarily fit into that binary definition of male and female.
There are many layers to a person's identity, and the gender unicorn is a graphic representation demonstrating the complexity of gender and sexuality. We need to make sure that the House of Medicine is not just inclusive and tolerant, but also accepting and welcoming to everyone, regardless of how they identify.
Yeah, we're sort of pulling back now to the bigger picture. Gender is not the only inequity in the House of Medicine. Although that's what we're focusing in on today's episode, there are many other biases that creep into medicine. Things like race, religion, socioeconomic status, mental health, physical ability, and just recently we did an episode on weight bias.
Right. And we need to be mindful of all of these biases and understand that in order to provide patients with the best care based on the best evidence, we need high quality, clinically relevant research that's inclusive and representative of everyone. And in order to do this, we need to remove inequities for those who generate research and provide care at the bedside. And finally, we need to recognize that everyone has value and should expect and deserve great care.
Yeah, in our opinion, there should be this progression from evidence-based medicine, and I'm using evidence-based medicine. Traditionally, it's been very male-dominated, to feminist-based medicine and some of those values, recognizing that there are gender inequities in all three pillars of the evidence-based medicine model.
Right, but this male-female dichotomy is a false one, right? Like you mentioned before. So the next step would be to be gender-based medicine, or GBM, which is a more inclusive concept no matter how you identify. And ultimately to humanist-based medicine, or HBM, because after all, there is only one race, right? The human race.
Yeah, and I hope people noticed that this was an alphabetical progression from EFGH, evidence-based medicine, feminist-based medicine, gender-based medicine, and ultimately to humanist-based medicine. We need to acknowledge and respect all diversity on this planet. Whoa, I think we're getting really preachy here, Suchi. So let's let's bring this back to something really tangible and clinical and something that we can bring to the patient's bedside. And we did mention cardiovascular care earlier, acute coronary syndrome, and gender bias can have a real impact on the care of these patients. So for this final section, let's go through and talk about some of the things that you can take to work to the patient's bedside on your next shift.
Right. And I love that we talk about cardiovascular care because as EM physicians, that's bread and butter for us, right? We treat patients who come in for possible ACS on a regular basis. Cardiovascular disease is the leading cause of morbidity and mortality in both men and women. But it's been reported that a greater proportion of women die from sudden cardiac death when compared to men. 52% in women versus 42% in men.
Okay, you're getting ahead of the data here. So let's unpack some of the data around cardiovascular disease and start with risk factors. I mean, most of us know the Framingham data. Even if we don't know that it's called the Framingham data, these are the traditional risk factors that we're all aware of. You know, hypertension, diabetes, high cholesterol, smoking, family history. This is what was used to create the Framingham Risk Score, or the FRS.
But not every patient fits nicely into that same box, right? And unfortunately, the FRS fails to capture certain factors that are either specific to or relatively more specific to women. And as a result, the FRS underestimates ischemic heart disease in women.
And that's a risk score projecting out further, you know, over the next few years. We want to know if the person in front of us is going to rule in or rule out for ACS. But there's an infographic from The Lancet, and it highlights the well-established risk factors that we've just been talking about, including high blood pressure, high sugar, high cholesterol, the smoking, obesity, diet, and family history.
And it also lists more sex-specific risk factors that we don't really think about often when we're assessing for ACS risk. Things like premature menopause or pregnancy issues like gestational diabetes, hypertension, preterm delivery, hormone replacement therapy, and polycystic ovarian disease. I know that I wasn't trained to think about these things deliberately.
I wasn't trained to think about these things either, and have only recently been more aware of it. So standing beside the gurney and seeing a patient with suspected ACS, and they're, you know, let's say they're in their mid-60s, I'm not going, so did you have gestational diabetes?
Right.
Did you have a preterm delivery? These things didn't come up. But there are also other risk factors that are more common in women. Things like autoimmune disease, like systemic lupus erythematosus or rheumatoid arthritis. These are much more common in women. And even radiation treatment for breast cancer. That too can increase cardiovascular risk.
And let's not forget to talk about the more underrecognized risk factors like abuse and intimate partner violence, socioeconomic deprivation, poor health literacy, and other environmental factors that can act as barriers to appropriate and regular care.
Well, those are some of the risk factors, and certainly there's some there that I had really been considering putting into that matrix, that gestalt at the bedside. But how about when women come into the ED and they get diagnosed with cardiovascular disease, but do they present differently?
So it turns out that most male and female patients with MIs still present with that, you know, very typical chest pain. But women are more likely to have atypical presentations when compared to men. And these atypical symptoms can be more vague and include shortness of breath, weakness, fatigue. And these differences in presentations are thought to contribute to delays in diagnosis.
Yeah, one of the things I also learned recently was to try to not use the term chest pain as often and talk about chest discomfort. Because, you know, when I ask people, oh, do you have chest pain? And they say no. And then they say, yeah, it's more like a heaviness, a squeezing, a tightness, an ache. And they may not actually identify as pain. So again, most male and female patients with MI still present with the typical, but you need to be inclusive by saying things like, are you having any chest discomfort, rather than specifically chest pain. And there's an infographic in our slides that shows that women can have different presentations depending on whether they were pre- or post-menopausal. But Suchi, do these gender biases lead to women being treated by the clinicians differently?
As it turns out, Ken, it actually does. Regardless of whether women are presenting with or without your classic chest pain, they are less likely to get timely therapies. And this includes getting less fibrinolytics and less primary PCI. Women who present with atypical presentations are also less likely to receive aspirin and other antiplatelet agents, heparin, beta blocker therapies during their hospitalization.
But does this translate, though, into worse outcomes? We know that we may not be thinking as much, identifying the risk factors. Even if we identify the patient is potentially having ACS or diagnosed with having ACS, they're less likely to get these evidence-based treatments. So what? I'm worried about patient-oriented outcomes, poo, not disease-oriented outcomes. So how does this work out with regards to poo?
So with regards to poo, unfortunately, yes, it does translate to worse outcomes. A study by Canto, published in JAMA in 2012, collected data from the National Registry of Myocardial Infarction, which included more than 1 million patients, with almost half of them being women. This study showed that women had a 4% absolute higher in-hospital mortality after presentation with ACS when compared to men.
Now, that would be an association because it's a registry study. So a 4% absolute increase in higher in-hospital mortality is associated with gender. So we're not doing a good job at diagnosing women or treating women with cardiovascular disease. However, we don't even know if some of these treatment strategies are the best treatment strategies for women. And this is because they are systematically excluded from clinical trials, like we mentioned earlier. What can we do? What can be done about this situation?
It's actually quite simple. We can start by including more women in clinical trials, and we can also raise more awareness among women about cardiovascular disease and educate clinicians more deliberately about the differences in presentations and possible biases that they may have.
Well, the Lancet article, which has a number of really good infographics, which are part of our slides, lists four strategies to increase the proportion of women in cardiovascular trials. Now, I wish they had five strategies, but okay. So let's go through their four strategies. Maybe I'll come up with a fifth.
Okay, so number one, be inclusive. Number two, meet women where they are. Number three, remove barriers. And number four, exchange knowledge. Ken, do you have a number five?
Yeah, I do. I just came up with it, and this might surprise you. Number five is be skeptical of the existing literature that is probably extrapolating from more male patients than female patients when it comes to the care of women and specifically cardiovascular disease. See? Five. It just comes like that. Be skeptical.
Good job. Good job.
All right. To summarize this final section on cardiovascular disease in women, there are some concerning numbers I want to leave you with. More than a third of all deaths in women worldwide are caused by cardiovascular disease. It's still the number one killer of women, just like in men. And so we need to focus on that. And if you get down to numbers, it's 275 million women were diagnosed with cardiovascular disease in 2019. And unfortunately, close to 9 million women died of cardiovascular disease in 2019.
So these are concerning and sad numbers, right? Especially if you're a woman or if you care about the wellness of women. And that's almost all of us, right? And all these numbers point to the fact that cardiovascular disease in women is understudied and women are underrepresented in clinical trials. That translates to cardiovascular disease in women being underrecognized in clinical presentations and women being underdiagnosed and undertreated and suffering from worse outcomes.
Well, this has to be one of the longest, and I have to say one of the best episodes that we've had on the SGEM. So let's circle back, though, and talk about those three objectives that we listed at the beginning of our presentation. So remember, there were three objectives. And the first one is, if you're an old white male doctor like me, hopefully you recognize, if you didn't a priori, that gender inequity does exist in this house of medicine.
And I hope that by sharing my story and my journey, it's provided you with the personal context and put a face to the issue.
And the second objective was that we hope you can appreciate that there are systematic gender inequities in each of the three pillars of the evidence-based medicine model.
Right. And we should be working towards a humanist-based medicine model that's inclusive of everyone.
So that we generate the literature that informs our care, that the clinicians are able to get the research grants and are paid appropriately, and that the patients are included in those research studies and that participate with providing their preferences and values into that clinical situation. And the third part was understand that these gender inequities can actually have a serious impact on our clinical management.
And the example that we used today to show this was that women with cardiovascular disease were underdiagnosed, undertreated, and had worse outcomes compared to men.
Well, Suchi, thank you very much for inviting me to come and present at your Grand Rounds, but also for making this presentation so much better. I think it was such a better presentation, hearing about your personal story, having your input, and having the two of us co-present as a team rather than just me giving a lecture on gender inequity.
That was really fun, Ken. I actually had a lot of fun co-presenting with you. And, you know, I think we actually made a difference at the Grand Rounds that day at Stony Brook. I think the residents and the faculty really enjoyed it. So thank you so much for doing this.
And I'll just remind everyone that the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine has been accredited for CME credits. So if you need to collect those things, if you want to collect those things and you're already listening to the show, why not click on the link and get some credit for what you're already doing? The content, it's always going to be free, part of the free open access to medical education movement and part of that philosophy. But if you want the credits, there is a small fee. Suchi, there's one final thing that we do at the end of the show, and that is for you to give the SGEM tagline.
Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it from the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next time.